Old Time Review Show podcast, brought to you by Southwaves Audio. Now here's your host, Jamie Dyer.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Old Time Review Show podcast. My name's Jamie Dyer and I'm joined today by actress Jane Grandel, who is in a few productions for Southwaves Audio, who also produced this podcast. So I've invited her on here today to give us her five recommendations for TV shows pre-1980. Will you please give us your first selection?
Hello, yes, my first selection, really in no particular order, just my favourite five. So the first on my list is What's My Line, but the US version.
Of course, because the British version ran on British TV in the 1950s and 60s all the way up to, I think like the early 90s, presented by Eamon Andrews. But of course, you're talking about the American version, which ran from 1950 to 67 and presented by John Daly.
That's right. I don't really know. I suppose I'd have to say I haven't actually seen that many episodes of the British version, or certainly as many as I have of the US version, but there's just something about the US version. And for me, it kind of has to be the episodes where the panel consisted of Dorothy Kilgallen, Bennett Cerf, Arlene Francis, and Fred Allen. He's kind of my favourite. Of course, John Charles Daly has to have a special mention because he, as the sort of chairman, he brings this kind of jovial and playful and sort of cheeky air to it, which you don't expect with a panel show from that era of that type, really.
There is something quite British about it, isn't it? It's very well mannered, and that's quite unusual for American game shows, certainly looking at it from a British point of view.
Yes, very much so. And yet it's so much more fun, I think, than our version. And I don't mean that in an insulting way. It just brings a smile to your face. And it doesn't matter what the profession of the people is that they're guessing, or who the guest stars are, the famous mystery guest. It's always fun. And I think for me, Fred Allen really helps that along, because I don't know, he kind of had this almost like naive quality, and it's just really endearing. But he's not constantly trying to push himself forward as the comedian, trying to find the jokes all the time. He's quite laid back for a comedian in that situation. They're not always like that on panel programmes.
Well, no, and certainly it's been shown by other comedians appearing on that show, either before Fred Allen or to replace him. He just seems to have this perfect balance of knowing when to be funny and playing the game quite adequately, really, and finding jokes out of almost nothing. Normally the funniest moments of Fred Allen on What's My Line are, in my opinion, whenever he says something and he has no idea why it's funny, but the audience are in absolute hysterics. Those are normally the best moments of Fred Allen on What's My Line.
Yes, definitely. I definitely agree with you there. It is when it comes out of nowhere and it's just so cute.
Well, there's just something about it. And I think they did kind of replace him quite adequately. They must have done, because it ran for a further 11 years after he sadly passed away. In my opinion, he is certainly one of the best panelists that they ever had. But it, you know, this isn't just about that one panelist. The other three also serve their purpose in the success of the format.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think because they're all different, they all serve a different purpose, and yet they work together so well. And you kind of get this little family vibe going on because they all work together on it for such a long time. They all know each other so well and know almost what each other are going to say. And they all have their particular role. So you as a viewer get to know what they're going to say and what their reaction is going to be to certain things.
They spent a long time working this stuff out. I mean, it had a really long run. What do you think was the behind the success of that?
I don't know. I think there's just a special vibe about it. I think it's one of those, the game is good, you know, it's intriguing, and obviously they put up on the screen what the person actually does, what their profession is, that the panel have to guess. And it's very entertaining when you see what it is, and you're almost, they had a live audience there when they were making the programme, and so you're sort of sharing the experience with them and seeing the panel struggle with it. And John's, he's kind of so gleeful about trying to deceive them.
Oh, his explanations as well are on another planet.
That's right. Yes. They're so convoluted sometimes, it's just hilarious.
And I don't think, I mean, they did do other versions after that, syndicated versions, but I don't think they quite got the almost like dryness of John Charles Daly.
No. It's funny, isn't it? Because he's the type of person you almost don't expect to see on an American show, because they don't always do that dry thing in the same way that we do. I think that's quite common here in the UK on our programme, certainly from that era. But when I first watched it, that was what was quite unexpected for me, because you don't see a lot of that.
Well, whenever you think of American game shows, you always think pow, 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 pow. It's in your face and it's there. And by stark contrast, you're sat watching What's My Line thinking, wow, you know, there's four people at a table wearing suits. There's a guy who's very well spoken, is a news anchor as his other job, and it's all just very well mannered and it's very unexpected. And I really, as a British viewer, I have no idea why it's never been shown in this country, other than the BBC want to force us with this this kind of thing that you know, we invented What's My Line, when of course it's a Goodson Todman thing. It's made in America. And to be honest, despite the fact that very few of those episodes exist in Britain, there are over 800 episodes of the American version that the British audience have never seen.
No, and because of its sort of dry, quite measured mood and vibe, I don't really see why it shouldn't be shown over here, because people would really get it. It isn't in your face, like you say. It's not any of the things that a lot of people associate in a negative way with some American programming.
No, it's certainly in a class of its own. That's What's My Line, which ran from 1950 to 67 in its original run. Let's move on to the next one. That was a rather lengthy conversation. What's your next choice?
Okay, well, my next choice, I think, has to be For the Love of Ada.
Which is, of course, a British show, which also is a movie. Let's not confuse it with the movie. And this show ran on ITV in the early 70s. Of course, has two really big, quite British actors that might not be familiar to American audiences, but they're basically British institutions, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, you can't really get better than Wilfred Pickles and Irene Handel, can you?
No, there's just something very quintessentially British about it. And certainly, I don't think it's been seen on TV for some time, has it? I mean, they recently have been showing it on Talking Pictures TV, which has become this kind of haven for vintage film and television in Britain. And certainly from watching it, it is in a little bit like What's My Line. It's in a world of its own.
Yes, it is. And I have to say, I've only recently discovered it on Talking Pictures. Like you say, I don't think it's been on for quite a long time. It's almost one of those things where I can see why it's not like a favourite rerun that's on all the time everywhere, because it does visually, and I suppose in its mood, it is kind of very of its time. It's not really groundbreaking, it's just kind of cozy, and so I suppose that doesn't travel quite as well as some other things have in terms of constant reruns and revisits and things. But I don't know, I just find Ada and Walter, the two main characters, so endearing, And I suppose cozy is the best word to describe it, but they are just utterly adorable.
And the thing I find on British TV these days is that cozy, you hardly see cozy anymore. Cozy's very underrated.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You can't beat cozy, though. I know that it's not fashionable. And everyone wants everything to be kind of, you know, in your face and pow, and it's got to have real meaning and punch and all of this stuff and say something in particular. But I don't know. I mean, personally, I watch television and film to escape and to just enjoy myself. And sitcoms are quite often my go-to thing because they're just nice. And nice is very, very underrated.
This show is a bit of an oddity because I get the feeling it was outdated when it ran originally. It has that kind of sleepy 60s feel about it, which is quite an unusual thing. And we should say that this is basically a little bit like an As Time Goes By thing, isn't it? Where basically it's about a couple in their elder years discovering each other.
That's right. But it almost, it's not a twist, but it's just a little something, a little subtle thing in the vibe. They're two characters, especially the character of Ada. Their ways are obviously older, more mature. They're sort of both in their 70s and they've got the outlook of that generation. But Ada is so, she's almost childlike. And the things she comes out with and the way that she's sort of quite jealous of anyone who talks to Walter and all this sort of thing. I think that's probably why it's still able to speak to me, even though I'm a lot younger than probably its target audience when it was made, because she's got that sort of much younger, almost girlish. She's got like a twinkle in her eye and her way of talking and her way of thinking of things is very sort of sweet and young.
And very kind of naive. And what I love is that kind of twist on the traditional format of normally it's like young lovers being looked upon by the elder generation. But in this, it's the other way around because of her daughter and son-in-law that are always watching her and watching what they're doing and making sure that they're not up to no good. That's a wonderful twist on what is quite a cliche situation.
Oh, it is definitely, because she lives with her daughter and son-in-law, doesn't she? And it's like they're the parents, and Walter calls round to call on her and take her out, and the daughter doesn't quite approve of him to start off with, and all of this. And it's just delightful. It just makes me smile every time.
And it's certainly worth checking out. And sadly, it's nearly at its end of run on Talking Pictures TV. But fear not, it is also available by Network, who have a wonderful range of vintage British sitcoms. If that is your thing, there's loads of them in there. I've spent many an hour looking over the selection of titles in Network, of which For the Love of Ada is one of them. Right, let's move on to the next choice.
Okay, so my next choice isn't a million miles away from my last one, but I was sat there thinking, what makes my top five most favourite, you know, things that I go to on a regular basis? And I thought, well, I can't leave The Good Life out, really.
Well, no, and it's worth saying for our American listeners that The Good Life is also known as Good Neighbours in the States when it was run on channels over there. So if you're listening in America and you were like, what's The Good Life? It's also called Good Neighbours. If you know a show by that name, that's what it is. And it is an absolute British classic. Richard Briers is at his best in this, as are, well, really, it's an all-star cast. Every cast member is memorable.
Yes, exactly. That was a point I was going to make, is that really, if you put those four together, you know, you've got Richard Briers, Felicity Kendall, Penelope Keith, and Paul Eddington, and you put those four together, and how could you go wrong? It's going to be brilliant immediately, isn't it? Because there's just so much talent there, and all four of them are those type of actors who, they bring something so sympathetic to all their characters. They really draw you in. And The Good Life, I think, is a prime example of that. And even though Tom, the main character played by Richard Briers, isn't really that likeable sometimes, he really kind of infuriates you and you feel sorry for his wife, the character Barbara. Really, in the end, there's still something quite endearing about him.
Never really picked up on it watching it as a child, but as an adult you do pick up on those sensibilities, and also the thing that it's kind of a class thing, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. It does sort of go down that road, doesn't it? And like you say, there's a lot in it. It's kind of one of those that's been constantly played throughout the years on TV. It's kind of one of those constant rerun things, isn't it? And you see it quite a lot, the same few episodes played over and over. And as a child, I kind of liked it because it was there, but I never really appreciated it. But then seeing it as an adult, when I got the box set and watched through from the beginning to end, you really start to appreciate, you know, all those subtleties and kind of the adult relationships and the friendship and the relationships between the two couples, both within the marriages and then as a group of four friends. Yeah, the class thing, it is quite funny because although they're sort of on the same level, it's kind of the wives who are different. The two men, Tom and Jerry, are sort of the same. They were almost on the same level when they were working together. And then Tom gives up his job to become self-sufficient. And I suppose it's their lifestyle, really, that denotes the class difference. But of course, Jerry's wife, Margot, I suppose she's quite sort of ambitious. And what did they call it? Upwardly mobile. She, you know, she's so impeccably dressed and everything, isn't she? And she knows how to give these lavish dinner parties for executives and all of this. And her house has got to be perfect. And she sort of looks down on them a little bit because they wear shabby clothes and they don't have all the latest things and a fancy car. But really, then they kind of always bust through that. That's kind of like the outer layer, the superficial thing. As an episode unfolds, then they go a bit deeper and you find actually, really, she's just as soft as anybody else and none of the class stuff actually matters. So they kind of dismantle that every time.
And you never get bored of it, which is a very strange thing because it's quite a gimmicky premise, really.
That's right. It is one of those things which almost shouldn't still work. But I think it is the character thing. Like the situation, yes, is funny, and the situations they get into, all their little predicaments and trying to work out, you know, how to barter for this and that and how to work things without any money. It's funny, and the kind of peripheral characters that they encounter and situations and things, they're always funny, but they're not really the thing that carries later, like that carries it through and makes it still relevant now. It's the characters and it's how relatable they are, and you get so fond of them. It's like they're your own next door neighbours, they're your own friends. You get that kind of ingrained in them that you can just watch it over and over, and it doesn't matter that you can almost recite the episode word for word because it's just, I don't know, again, it's just kind of delightful. It just makes you smile.
And that's one of those situations again, isn't it? Where, as you say, you want to just keep watching.
Exactly. And you see an episode on the TV and you can't say no. You have to sit there and watch the rest.
Yes. Now, that is The Good Life, of course. Classic 70s comedy from Britain, also known as Good Neighbours in the United States. Let's move on to the next choice, shall we? This is your fourth choice, right?
Yes, my fourth choice. And I thought I would bring in a contingent from sort of a slightly different style of programme. I've gone for The Saint with Roger Moore.
Now, this is a classic thing where a lot of American audience, or certainly some of them, think that this actually originates from America, but it's an ITC production, isn't it?
Yes. I think he had been in America prior to doing it for some years, doing television and things there, and then came back here and started The Saint and worked here for quite a few years doing that and other things before Bond, of course.
Yes, and the thing about The Saint is you've mentioned it there, you do kind of go, well, this is before Bond, this is like his audition tape.
Yes, there is a little bit of that feeling, isn't there?
And that because he was over in the States doing Maverick just before starting The Saint, his accent is all over the place.
Yes. Now, it's strange because my first encounters with The Saint was when it was run on channels like ITV4. And of course, over here, they kind of have a thing about showing black and white television. They don't do it very often. And so they only used to show the colour episodes, which are from, I suppose, the last 2 or 3 years of the run. So, of course, he's got his impeccable British accent back by then. And then I got the black and white box set of the first few series, and watching the initial episode, you're like, "Ooh, what's going on with his accent here? It's kind of like a transatlantic thing."
Yeah, it is really odd, but it allowed them, as with a lot of ITC programs, it allowed them to be able to sell the show abroad because he had kind of a popularity around the world at that time, before becoming Bond, of course.
That's true. And I believe that was kind of the thing that catapulted him everywhere. Pre-Bond, he was already quite a massive star because, of course, television, and particularly programmes like that made by ITC, as you say, they were sold everywhere. So pretty much every country everywhere knew who he was.
Yes. And when you watch the show, it doesn't really age that much either. It's quite a timeless piece.
Yes, there are. And it's funny you should say that, because I was just thinking that actually, again, I think the black and white episodes are in a strange way more timeless than the later colour episodes. By the time they got onto the colour, I think it had become almost a bit too formulaic and a little bit tired. And I suppose they were sort of trying to progress a bit more, where things had changed slightly, styles in programming had changed slightly, I guess, so they were moving it along a little bit. But the earlier episodes from, I think, like early 60s, it feels a bit more classic and a bit more, there was that sort of tongue-in-cheek, light-hearted layer, but not too much. It took itself just seriously enough, I think, in the beginning to really sort of draw you in.
It is a strange one. I've not seen very many of them. I mean, are you saying that if you come into this, I mean, a lot of the a lot of those series didn't have kind of continuing storylines. Is it worth watching it from the beginning?
Well, it's worth it, but I wouldn't say by any means necessary. I suppose from my point of view, what I'm saying is I prefer it from the beginning, but before I'd seen any of those, I very much used to enjoy the colour episodes that they ran on TV. So you can come in anywhere and enjoy it, to be honest. They put it in an hour slot, so it's, you know, sort of 45 minutes-ish of just sort of light-hearted, adventurous fun, really.
Well, yes, and alongside British show The Avengers is one of our most popular imports stateside from that era.
Yes, I would imagine so. And I think, obviously, based on it ran for quite a long time, so there's a lot of episodes, and then Roger Moore going on to do Bond afterwards, I suppose it's been given an extra life because of that, because his fame continued and grew. So it's got this extra draw because everybody knows who Roger Moore is.
Well, yes, and will do for many years to come because of The Saint and Bond, of course. We've got about 5 to 10 minutes left. Let us know about your fifth choice.
Okay, so I know this is going to sound a bit of an obvious one, and I'm probably way behind everyone else who already knows it and loves it, and the generations that have seen it, and it's kind of this iconic thing. In the UK, we haven't really had access to it in my lifetime until Amazon recently added it to their Prime Video service. And, of course, I'm talking about Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In.
Which was, even for the time, it was absolute. I mean, I'm in your camp where I've literally only just discovered it. I knew it existed and I'd seen little clips and I'd seen people reference it many a time. But as it wasn't until it was on Amazon that I discovered it, because it just hasn't been on here for over 30 years. And that was even just the first 2 or 3 seasons. They haven't really shown the others for a long, long time. But even watching now, it is insanely provocative, isn't it?
It really is. That is the word, isn't it? Because, I mean, on the face of it, you look at it and you go, okay, it's a late 60s, early 70s sketch show. comedy show, you know, it's got some bits, it's got some regular characters, it's got guest stars. I suppose the only thing that on the face of it makes it different from our kind of sketch variety programs of the time is that they don't really have musical numbers as such, apart from when it's kind of incorporated in a sketch. You look a little bit deeper and you go, okay, it's just a chaotic collection of sort of silly stuff. And I guess it kind of is in some ways, but in this case, I don't think that has to be a bad thing. Once you see an episode or two, you kind of come out the other end going, whoa, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah, I remember the first time I watched a full episode. I watched the pilot and I'm sat there and I'm thinking, this is nuts. I think of myself as a humongous television fan. I've seen some of the most obscurest stuff you could ever see. But that was one of the most chaotic, inspirational, ridiculous, and yet utterly brilliant and delightful pieces of television I'd ever seen. And I just wanted to watch more. There's kind of an addictive quality to it, isn't there?
There is. It's almost like it's so overstimulating that when it's finished, you're like, I need more, I need more. It's like you get to the end and you feel exhausted because there is so much going on. It just kind of bombards you. You almost don't know what's going on. You see one thing and you see another and you forget what's gone before because the pace is so insane, and it's just, it kind of slaps you in the face. And then the episode eventually finishes, because I haven't seen all of them by any means, but some of the ones I've seen, they kind of run all of the sketches over the credits, so you've got the credits going up and then they're still going, still more is coming, and then you're like, oh, it's gonna finish, and then there's more, and then there's more, and you almost feel like it's never gonna end, but that's not a bad thing. And then it does come to an end and you're like, oh, it's kind of this real letdown feeling, and you're like, shall I watch the next one? But it's sort of I'm in two minds because it's so much. Can I cope with two in a row?
And part of the thing is that, you know, that as with a lot of humour, certainly stuff that's fairly topical, because it's going to be, because that's part of its thing, it's a satire, is that a lot of it doesn't carry over very well. So you get the odd sexism and racism and all this stuff, but it doesn't feel like, it feels like even then they're saying this is wrong.
Yes, exactly. You encounter a lot of things like that in it, don't you? Moments where they'll say something and you're like, whoa. Really? Did they think then, even then, that it was okay to say this? You're sort of shocked by it. And then you kind of give yourself a moment to process, and it's like, oh no, okay, they said it so sort of overtly that it just sort of, it slaps you around the face and you go, oh, I get it. They're laughing at someone who would think that.
Yeah, and the genius bit about it is that when you look at Dan Rowan and Dick Martin, they do not look like this is the show for them. They look so out of place. They look like the old guard. And that is part of the genius of it, is that it's fronted by these two rather safe performers who bring along some of the most established of guests to kind of revel in this absolute ridiculousness. And that's what makes it brilliant. It kind of puts you in a safe place before it hits you around the head.
Well, that's right. And you said about like established names as guest stars. It is kind of insane, the people that they get. And then you look at it and go, these people must have really wanted to do this. And they didn't just do it once. They kept coming back and doing it again. And it's just, you know, you've got people like Jack Benny and John Wayne. John Wayne was like the most American person you can think of. And a lot of the things that they say on Laugh-In are kind of quite political. And, you know, if you kind of hear or read anything about someone like John Wayne, he wouldn't have approved of everything that they were saying, but, or certainly shared the view. But he obviously wanted to do it anyway, because it's just such a, I don't know, like there aren't, this is what I get when I watch it. You finish watching it and you're like, I've just seen so much. My mind is completely blown. I can't remember all the things I just saw, and I certainly don't have words to describe it.
Well, no. And like you say, with the established stars thing, the amount of names, I mean, I'm not going to read them out to you because we'd be here forever, but the amount of names, big names, if you know Hollywood and TV from the late 60s, well, no, if you know Hollywood and TV from the 40s up to the 70s, pretty much every massive name appeared on that show. And it is insane the amount of big names that went on there. And most of what they say is utter dribble, really. But it all makes sense. And this show really deserves like 5 podcasts just to analyze the first episode. I mean, it's just amazing. I know this is your selection, but for me, I think that would be on my list as well, because it was one of the most mind-blowing pieces of television I'd ever seen. And to be honest, if anyone walked up to me and goes, oh, I saw this new thing, it was mad, I'd say, no, you need to go and see that, because I think it's a definite watch, certainly if you're interested in that era.
Absolutely. And like you say, I honestly don't think there could be anything that's been made since then, or that probably could be made in the future, that could be quite that mad. I mean, it is indescribable. You sort of have to see it to believe it.
The only thing that comes to mind when I think of something that might have been similar would be the work of people like Rick Mayall and all that alternative comedy stuff. That is the only stuff, certainly in this country, that I can think that really comes close to it.
Yes, I suppose so, because you're sort of searching for something that has that same level of sort of that frantic feeling. It's like it's so on the edge of sanity sometimes.
Which brings us very nicely, not to the end, because I just want to give a shout out to Joanne Worley, who of course is one of the regulars in the early seasons of Laugh-In, who for us as British viewers had never really seen her before. And this is the thing, right? I always say this, whenever there is any old media, do not dismiss it, because the only old media that really comes through to the everyday public in everyday life is Disney movies, right? And when you look at the filmography of Joanne Worley and you see she was in Beauty and the Beast, and you think, well, I don't know who that is. When you see her in Laugh-In, you know exactly why they chose her for that role all those years later. Because you mentioning On the Edge of Sanity, she has that beautiful way. And they must have known, because they make a big deal of her as it goes along in the seasons, don't they?
Yes, they do. I don't think it's just because I like her so much as a performer and she's so good. I think it genuinely is. They gave her some of the best lines. And when we say lines, it's not always a character in a sketch. It's sometimes just this character that she does so well, that she's sort of cultivated like a version of herself, that sort of, like we say, that is the way to describe it. On the edge of sanity, she's got this almost like maniacal laugh, and it's just utterly brilliant. I'm laughing now just thinking about it.
She's got kind of that Jim Carrey thing going on, where it's like she can just make you laugh with the flailing of her limbs. It's just hilarious.
Yes,
it's
she
just
has
utter hilarious. But the thing is, for British viewers, and we're going to round this off. For British viewers, it was shown on BBC Two in the 60s. And Laugh-In doesn't look like it should be anywhere near BBC Two. It looks more like it should be on ITV at like 12 o'clock at night, in the middle of the night, perhaps, with about 5 hours of warning beforehand. Certainly in the modern era, anyway. I get why it was on BBC Two, but it does seem quite bizarre.
It does. It's almost got the kind of vibe where you go, it shouldn't have even been on ITV. It's like a Channel 4 thing.
Years and years later, it's like a thing like that. But of course, they had some British writers involved. I mean, just looking at the credits the other day, Barry Took, who did a lot of Round the Horn and things like that.
Yes, and in some ways, I suppose that explains maybe why it talks to us, because he was a British comedy writer and worked on stuff like Round the Horn and that kind of thing, I think. And I suppose that explains it, because you do get, moments of that kind of, it's innuendo, but it's not like wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's like they almost deliver it in such an obvious way that they credit you with the intelligence to know it's innuendo. They almost do it with such a sincerity that it's up to you to realise that it is a wink, wink, nudge, nudge moment.
And that seems like a good place to stop. Thank you for joining me today and giving us your top five. It's been wonderful to find out kind of some of these American shows from a British perspective. It's always interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Old Time Review Show podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Find out more about the show at southwavesaudio.co.uk and like our page on Facebook. See you on the next podcast. We'll be right back.